Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, forget Jeremy Hunt's last budget. What about Rachel Reeves' first budget? In the last 50 years, just two Labour shadow chancellors have gone on to deliver a budget. So we take a look at exactly what she can or can't do, given the state of the nation's finances. In The Columnist, Manveen Rana and Matthew Paris discuss the prospects of a ceasefire in Israel and how far is too far to go running with your dog. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, don't forget you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. Just as we come on air, a little bit of good news. Well, I mean, if you're me, I mean, you probably, yeah, I assume you couldn't give a monkey's, but the show has been nominated for Radio Programme of the Year at the Broadcasting Press Guild. I mean, obviously we won't win, but I think this is one that might involve a team lunch, so that's something. We're up against James O'Brien on something called LBC. Oh, I heard about that. Is that a local thing? Does he spin the discs over there? The Briefing Room by someone called David Aronovich. Ah, the legend. The legendary David Aronovich. And The Great Post Office Trial by Nick Wallace for Radio 4, which I assume. I mean, God love David Aronovich and James O'Brien and me. But the guy who got justice for the Sun Postmasters, I suspect, might win that one. But anyway, it's nice to be nominated. And in the tweet, it's been retweeted by James O'Brien, and now there's just lots of people with EU flags in their name joining in, so that's lovely. Anyway, it's nice to be nominated. We don't do it for the baubles, obviously. Right, but you know, maybe, you know, they've heard, I haven't just been, this week I've been name-checked by Chris Evans on Virgin Radio, and then yesterday, well, if I don't win an award for what I do on this show, I'll definitely be winning an award for my broadcasting on Talk Sport. I went upstairs last night, yesterday afternoon, because they wanted to know all about the budget and the definition of the blind leading the blind. This is what happened when I went on Talk Sport Drive with Andy Goldstein and Darren Bent.
Talk Sport.
When we found out you were coming in,
yeah,
right, Benty mentioned a former Prime Minister,
yeah,
and called him James Cameron.
Right.
That's the level you're dealing with in this studio. I'm not making that up.
I concentrate.
Just in the opinion polls.
Yeah.
And so it just looks like Keir Starmer's going to be Prime Minister. So what they did today, it's nice if you're going to get a bit of money back in your pay packet, but it's not going to make them more popular. It's not going to get them back in the game, to use the jargon.
Like it, yep.
I think they
connect everything to football.
I think they're heading for relegation. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who are the people in charge now?
The people in charge now, the Conservatives, okay, Rishi Sunak, Jeremy Hunt's the Chancellor.
Yep.
So if you think, let me try and think of it. If it's like the, is it like the transfer window?
Let's go to the transfer window.
Today is like a big moment for them to do something different. You know, bringing some, yeah, I suppose a reshuffle's more like transfer, like bringing some new players. There's like some new ideas, shake things up a bit, try and get back in the game. I don't think on this basis they will. So I suspect we're going to have to hang on to an election in the autumn.
I think the best way to compare it, Benty, yeah, is it's like Sir Jim Ratcliffe buying a quarter of Man United, saying, we're going to fix the roof, we're going to bring in a new CEO, we're going to bring new players in, hoping to keep the fans happy with the Glazers, but ultimately they still want the Glazers out.
Yeah.
I think that's a good analogy, isn't it?
That's not bad.
You like that, Benty?
And actually, because people are still so cross about the Glazers, they're still cross about Liz Truss and Boris Johnson and all that.
Mm.
And ultimately, they want a complete change.
Don't forget, Matt, of course, returns Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. on Times Radio. Download the TalkSport app. Swipe right until you find Times Radio, then enjoy.
So, you know, if politics was like that, he's a funny guy.
Yeah.
I quite enjoy that, but all the other stuff.
Yeah, if you do politics... Well, his show... Hold on, I've got the name of his show, which I think it works. His show is... Oh, it's gone now. Politics Without the Boring Bits.
Yeah, I like
that. Works.
Yeah.
Do your little football analogy, then you have our attention.
Yeah.
If you talk proper...
No.
If you talk proper, you won't get us.
I don't have a clue what...
All right?
Yeah.
No, nor me. But we've done it now.
Yeah.
And we've done it well.
Talk Sport.
We've done it now, and we've done it well. That's the best. Can we get... We should turn that into a trail for the show. Well, there we are. I enjoyed it. Darren Bent, Andy Goldside, thank you for having me on. it was a lot of fun. I didn't get a chance, though, to talk to them about the finer details of the budget, but it turns out Jeremy Hunt has been listening to the How to Win an Election podcast. Yeah. So on Tuesday, this was Peter Mandelson on How to Win.
Keir Starmer needs to shed a few pounds, and that would be an improvement.
Well, this was Jeremy Hunt in the budget.
I see the Leader of the Opposition smiling because, like me, he is a Surrey boy. I know he's been taking advice from Lord Mandelson, who yesterday rather uncharitably said he needed to shed a few pounds. Ordinary families will shed more than a few pounds if that lot get in.
Turns out he's listening. Good morning, Chancellor.
Manveen Rana and someone called Matthew on Times Radio.
Yes, Manveen Rana's here.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well.
Matthew Powis is here.
Couldn't be better.
And even better news, in front of me, there is a box with the words patisserie fine.
We're not, what have you're, we in got?
Oh,
you're in luck.
Have you had one already, Matthew?
Two.
You've had two? My goodness.
We've got stuck in already.
Well, we're glad you're back. Obviously, it was nice that you were out reporting and things, but we're glad that you're back with us, Manveen. We should obviously start with the budget, and then we can rake over the entrails one more time before we put it to one side. And whether or not we think this is a pre-election budget, is it going to shift the dial? Is it actually about stitching up the Labour Party? This was Jeremy Hunt. He was on Breakfast this morning. He was asked whether there would be another fiscal event before the election.
No, but you know, if there is if there's an autumn election, which is the working assumption, then theoretically it would be possible to have one. But you know, that's a decision that's above my pay grade, Steve.
So he doesn't know. What do you think, Matthew?
I think December 2025, because if you
2025,
know,
you mean 2024?
No, 2025. So not this year at all. That's the last possible date he could have an election. And I think if you know you're going to lose, you just carry on until you have to put it to the test. So that's what I'd do. And it makes him, at least on the books, Prime Minister for 3 years, although it wouldn't really be 3 years.
Oh, that's true. If he just tips over to
January.
Yes, yeah. What do you make of it all, Mammy? Sorry, I am now eating one of your lovely...
Of course you are.
Lovely pan and chocolate. So we'll just talk for the next 10 minutes.
Oh, OK. No, I'll see what I can do. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't much of a pre-election budget, was it? I mean, the big rabbit out of a hat was one everyone was expecting, which had zero impact. Well, last time it was introduced in the autumn. I don't know why it would be any different now.
It's got myxomatosis, that rabbit.
Not working, is it?
It's interesting though, because some Tory MPs I spoke to tried to make the case that, like, they tried big bang surprise whiz, but you know, and that's what got them into this mess. You know, Liz Truss did all of the rabbits.
Yeah, but she didn't do any of the rabbits that most voters would have benefited from. You know, most voters sort of heard that and thought, oh my God, this is catastrophic. Unless you were sort of, you know, a bank with a big bonus or, you know, at the top rate of income tax. You know, like, you know, who was going to benefit?
Wasn't there a penny off income tax or two? I can't remember.
By then it was just, you know, the markets were in.
But there isn't any money.
There isn't any money.
And so, you know, you no money, no rabbit.
And the electorate's sort of quite responsible. I think they know that. Nobody, yes. You know, if all the polling shows they'd much rather you were investing in the NHS and education than cutting tax right now. I thought politically it was a weird move because, I mean, there's nothing they can do that's going to win them the election at this point. There was nothing that they could have presented, I think, yesterday, particularly given the underlying numbers. But stealing Labour's policy on non-doms, you know, while it's sort of leaves Labour in a bit of a mess and flailing, I don't know if it's great for the Tories. The only people I've heard in the last 6 months saying they will vote Tory have been either non-doms who are from the Commonwealth and allowed to vote, or people who are rich enough to have quite a lot of property in London who think the moment the non-doms thing came in with Labour, their property would go down and therefore, you know, they were all for propping up the Tories. I feel like they've just lost an entire constituency who were going to vote for
them. The last people.
The last people, and they're gone.
Can you vote if you're a non-dom?
If you're from the Commonwealth.
Hmm.
Excellent knowledge.
I've literally heard this from several people who are sort of non-doms, and they were, you know, worrying about having to leave the country if Keir Starmer got in, but now it's happened anyway. I don't think they're going to stick around long enough to vote at the election.
I think it was really a good move, really, the non-doms.
I think it had to happen.
Yes.
But it is problematic.
But I think just as a political move.
I haven't seen it as yet, but the... Presumably the Labour Party right now are clipping up every single time that Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak said this was a bad idea.
Yeah.
It would lead, you know, it wouldn't raise any money. It would lead to... They were literally doing that like a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
So it just doesn't make them look... They're big, eye-catching, populist ideas.
Well, also, it just reminds people that the Prime Minister's wife will pay more tax.
We'll have to pay
which
more.
Has been an awkward sort of
You could argue the other way. You could say, well, the Prime Minister's family have actually benefited from non-dom status. Nevertheless, he thinks it's right for the country that it should go.
Yeah,
but in terms of reinforcing the idea, they've essentially run out of ideas and road.
Yeah.
It doesn't scream.
It's not a great look.
Yeah, changey. But do you think he will be able to lead the Tories into the next election, Matthew? Rishi Sunak?
It's too late now to change. And I don't see any change that would be better than Rishi Sunak. His ratings are not good, nor particularly a Keir Starmer's, but on the whole, people don't think he's mad, which the last Conservative Prime Minister was. They don't think he's wicked, which the one before that one was. They don't think he's almost catatonically unable to speak, which Theresa May was. So,
turns out it's a low bar.
Yeah, it's a low bar.
Yes, yeah.
And actually, maybe going right back to... I don't know what version of Rishi Sunak we're on now. If we went back to Rishi Sunak 1.0, which was calm, steady, hardworking, diligent, decent, just getting on with the job, that's probably still his best bet, not for winning, but for limiting, you know, a boring budget, saying we can't do much more, but we're doing what we can, we're going to try and fix things as we go along. That still feels like his best pitch, doesn't it?
His best, I mean, it's not a great pitch to win an election. I sort of, this is going to sound very cynical, I sort of think for everybody in the Tories now, it's much more about their best pitch for what they do after the next election. So I think basically he needs to do nothing catastrophic that will limit his job prospects and what he does after he leaves politics.
I wouldn't announce a tax on Meta.
No, that's what I mean.
and what he's going to do after the election too, I'm quite sure he won't stay. He wants to be remembered as someone who steadied the ship. I think that's the best
competent
he can hope for. Yeah.
Well, if there is anyone waiting in the wings who could replace Rishi Sunak, what about David Cameron, who popped up on Twitter this week with a video of him listing all the things he's been busy doing in his 100 days as Foreign Secretary. And all he seems to have done is reminded voters and Tory MPs that there's this sort of quite competent, hardworking, good communicator just waiting in the wings.
Yes, he reminds us of what we don't have anymore. We weren't crazy about him when he was Prime Minister, but you
had don't know what you've got till it's gone, Matthew.
Yes, that's right. I think he's doing well. He's got just the right sort of smooth manner and a sense of balance and proportion and precaution that looks good in a foreign secretary. I had this idea in a notebook I did for the Times the other day. Well, I didn't. A friend of mine, Sam Hogg, who does a Beijing to Britain China bulletin, suggested that what we need to do is steady and revive the idea of the free world, which was in the 20th century. Everybody talked about the free world, freedom's frontiers, all that kind of thing. There is such a thing as the free world, and a British Foreign Secretary tour of countries we know to be democratic, friendly with liberal values, just to congratulate them, basically, I think would be quite a good idea.
Well, with so many countries voting this year, you could go and welcome, you know, make a point of meeting the new governments and all
that's
that.
That's a good idea.
Spend the year doing that. I mean, I've just come back from Jerusalem, and what was really interesting is that when you speak to Palestinians there, they follow British politics very closely. They were very down on Rishi Sunak after his speech the other day. You know, I had lots of Palestinian Christians.
What, the one on in Downing Street?
The one where he came out on Downing Street. The big address about values. there was a lot of anger on the ground, a lot of sort of, you're not doing anything to stop the deaths in Gaza. A lot of Palestinian Christians saying, you know, you haven't turned up, you haven't done anything to help with aid, you're not getting aid in, people are dying. And rather than criticising that, you're calling this Islamist. We're Palestinian Christians, thousands of us are dying by the day, and you don't notice it. Real anger on the ground. But the funny thing is, the one person they are very nice about is David Cameron. They feel like he's sort of... he's had a couple of interventions where he's talked about, you know, potentially recognising a Palestinian nation. So he's suddenly a hero there. They even said to me, this could be the moment, like Kosovo, where Britain ends up leading America towards sort of a better, more moral foreign policy when the Americans don't show up. So they sort of, they see that as being a real moment of hope. Really interesting. I mean, I haven't heard anyone talk about David Cameron like that here.
But he has his position, although he has, you know, been full square, side by side with Rishi Sunak and all that, he has been nudging the lines. And in a, there was a debate a couple of days ago in the House of Lords where he was quite critical of Israel and said, you know, these are the tough questions that we need to be asking. Actually, in a way, and maybe it's because he's in the House of Lords, and maybe it's because he's a former Prime Minister, actually going much further than I think Rishi Sunak has.
He has already, certainly. Yeah. And he's almost the only person in the government who can get away with it. You couldn't really do it in the cabinet. They're all looking over their each other's shoulders and thinking about the next leadership election. And Cameron doesn't really care about the next leadership election. He can't be sacked. He can say absolutely what he likes.
Do you think it's also partly because we know he's coming from the place of the mushy centrist and not sort of culture war-y, you know, stirring upness? If Suella Braverman or someone said exactly the same thing, you'd think, oh, what's she up to? This, you know, that's a dog whistle. You know,
She's gone the other way.
Exactly. But if the dog whistlers say things, then you sort of, you immediately assume they're dog whistling. Whereas David Cameron is coming from a, you know, the baggage he brings is different.
That's the point you make, that is the point, I think, of him. You can't say what's he up to. Yeah. He isn't up to anything.
Yeah,
yeah, which definitely helps.
Yeah.
But, you know, it feels like it's a really odd moment where I don't think anybody in cabinet, everyone's just looking at the next election and survival. I don't think that they think about how this stuff plays out across the world. Mm. You know, across the Arab world, across the Middle East, across all the people we want sort of trade deals with, it's not going down well. And David Cameron is coming out as the only hero because they think he's the only one sort of sticking his neck out.
Well, it is interesting to see whether or not he sort of stretches even further and exerts more authority. But I mean, the other thing is, what he's done to restore his own reputation. It wasn't that long ago. Yeah. Everyone was taking the mick about Greenshill and in the shed and didn't know what to do with himself and lining his own pockets. And now he's, you know, back as a statesman.
He's risen above shepherd's huts and all that kind of thing.
It's extraordinary. Maybe we'll see Rishi Sunak back in Keir Starmer's cabinet. There was somebody, who was it suggested, was it George Osborne or Ed Ball suggested that Keir Starmer should keep him on?
Keep him on?
As Foreign Secretary.
What?
I don't know if it was just designed to wind up David Lammy.
Also, I'm not sure his reputation has gone down very well across the world, so not sure that would be an asset.
No, keep on David Cameron, not Rishi
Sunak. Fair enough.
David Cameron is Foreign Secretary.
Yeah, as a goat.
Bring back the goats.
Yeah.
That's what we want. We want more goats. In a moment we're going to talk about dogs, keeping the animal theme going, but I just want to talk about this extraordinary story about Michelle Donnellan, the science secretary, libelled someone on Twitter, and then is the taxpayers footing the £15,000 bill for damages and legal fees. And no one seems willing to defend this. It's astonishing.
The reason they aren't willing to defend it, at least in government, is that anybody who's in politics is always afraid of defaming somebody, because it's the nature of politics that you say nasty things about other people. The other reason probably is that it'd be very hard to draw the line as to where a minister should be defended because they were speaking as a minister and where they shouldn't because they were speaking as themselves. I agree that the result here looks very odd, counterintuitive, but I think it's probably right. She was speaking as a minister, I think.
She was speaking as a minister, but I'm not sure it was really part of her, you know, ministerial duty to be making the point she was making. It goes back to something that actually Matthew wrote in his last column about values. I think it's really dangerous when the government is sort of straying into sort of working out what they think, you know, the imposing values, which is what this entire tweet was about. You know, it was interfering with academic freedom in a way that the government has been saying they don't want people to be doing, you know, very ironically. Also, it just wasn't very clever. You know, Matthew's right, you know, you're very careful about not defaming people, but there's always been a method, if you're a politician, where you can, which is to do it in Parliament, because you don't get sued for anything you say in the chamber. But she decided to go and do it on Twitter.
There's also just a massive sort of power imbalance of a cabinet minister singling out a tweet by one academic.
Two academics, but
to a news story.
But also without checking.
Yeah.
Without checking anything and jumping in. I mean, which anybody should, you know, everyone should be aware of this stuff for defamation. No, nobody else would do it. If you're a minister, you should be doubly sure.
Yeah.
I don't see why we should be paying for a massive mistake.
Well, what she did is indefensible, certainly. Yeah. But on the other hand, we're broadcasters, we're journalists.
Yeah.
On the whole, our newspaper would probably stand behind us. If in something we wrote or said.
If it was a tweet,
I'd always assume they wouldn't.
I was going to say, it's not one I'd want to test.
I assume that if I said something on here on the basis of a sort of editorial decision, I'd hope that Times Radio would get the checkbook out. But if I went and said something on Twitter, which and also I suppose because we know the rules on libel and all that, so that's why I'd apply the same test. But
I
there's only one way to find out. I tell you what, I'll go online now and libel Matthew, and then we'll see what happens. Now, did you see Jeremy Hunt? He went on a 17-mile run before the budget yesterday, and for 9 miles of it, he had his dog, Poppy. Good dog name. That's what our dog's called. The Labrador. Although, I have to say, in some of the pictures, she didn't look very happy. The RSPCA has now put out a warning that not all dogs have that sort of endurance. Well, Zoe Willingham is a dog behaviourist who joins us live from Crusts. Hello, Zoe.
Hello.
So, how far can you run with a dog for?
Well, I think it depends on the dog. It depends on their breed, their fitness, whether they've worked up to it, whether they're used to it, whether you've got the right equipment. There's a whole host of things you need to consider when you're going running with a dog.
Is 9 miles too much?
Not if the dog's fit, healthy, bred for that type of work and is able to build up to it. So in the case of Jeremy Hunt's dog, it looked fairly fit and healthy, looked like it worked up to it. The only thing was he wasn't really wearing the right equipment to be running the dog. He could have really done with the proper equipment
What's the right equipment?
So the right equipment for a dog is to wear a proper running harness. So you can actually buy Canicross running harnesses, and that's much more comfortable for the dog, and it's safer, and it's safer for the operator as well. So that's really important to have the right equipment if you're going to run a dog.
Matthew, you famously hold the record for MPs running the marathon. Would you have been able to do it as fast if you'd had a dog with you?
I think so. I imagine in the dog world now, as we speak, they're discussing whether the dog should have taken Jeremy Hunt for a run.
It's really embarrassed by it, the whole thing.
But apparently, and our expert will confirm or deny this, I think I read it on Twitter, start with a pack of assorted genders and species, say a man, a woman, a horse and a dog, and start them running down an endless road, and the dog will be the first to fall by the wayside, the horse will be the next to fall by the wayside, the man will be the next to fall by the wayside, and the woman will come into her own in about 100 miles, something like that.
I didn't know that. Yeah. No idea. I mean, I wouldn't be me. I don't think I'd make it to 100 miles, but apparently in 100 miles, they beat men.
Mm.
And horses are 25 miles.
Would you like to have a go at that, Zoe? If we can get hold of a horse?
I don't think I'd want to go 100 miles. I think I'd be all right in a couple with a dog. That would be fine for me.
And how's Crufts? That's like your Glastonbury, isn't it?
Yeah, Crufts is like, it's like a sweet shop for me. It's amazing. It's really electric in there today. No, I just go around and buy loads of stuff for my dogs at home. So, yeah.
How many dogs have you got, Zoe?
I've got 31 dogs myself.
31?
Whoa.
Yeah, 31 dogs, all rescues.
Wow. Well done for that. Never mind Jeremy Hunt.
How do you walk them all? I mean, like as a pack or...?
Yeah. So I actually bought them some land and fenced it all in, and we walk them all together, all 31 of them, all together over there. Because they've all got special needs, so we had to do special things for them.
Well, hats off to you, Zoe.
Must be
more like a game reserve.
Well, get off and buy as many squeaky toys. All 31 of them need a new toy, Zoe.
Thanks for having me on.
Nice to speak to you. Take care. That's Zoe Willingham there. Dog behaviourist live from Crufts. 31 dogs.
I can't believe that.
That's mad.
My mind is completely stuck on the practicality.
I always admire teachers if they've got 31 children in their lesson, but 31 yes. dogs. That's
never work with either.
All I'm thinking about is the poo bags.
I'm thinking about that too.
Oh, God. Oh.
Manveen Varner and Matthew Paris. You can catch Manveen on the Stories of Our Times podcast and Matthew Paris in the Times every week with your subscription. Up next, Rachel Weeves' first budget.
The Big Thing.
Tomorrow is my turn, no more doubts, no more fears.
The post of Chancellor of the Exchequer has existed now for 800 years. In that time, not one single woman has held that post. I intend to address this hall as Britain's first female Chancellor of the Exchequer. In my first budget as Chancellor of the Exchequer, I will end the tax loophole which exempts private schools from paying VAT. I will be a responsible Chancellor. I will be Britain's first Green Chancellor. As Chancellor, I will put forward a new charter for budget responsibility.
Tomorrow is my turn.
So, is it Rachel Weeves' turn? It would mean defying history. In the last 50 years, only two Labour shadow chancellors have gone on to deliver a budget. As she was saying, there's never been a female Chancellor of the Exchequer. And if Rachel Weeves does get into the Treasury after the next election, what will it look like? What will be waiting for her? What can she promise in a Labour manifesto? We're going to find out with three expert Labour watchers, including former advisers to Keir Starmer and a former adviser to Alistair Darling, the last Labour Chancellor. But first, let's ask the crucial question. Will there be any money? Jack Barnett is the economics correspondent at the Times and is here. Jack, is there any money?
I think there is. There is money. It just depends on, you know, what the party who is in charge wants to do with the resources available to them. I mean, if you look at the Office for Budget Responsibility's forecast yesterday, before any measures were announced from Jeremy Hunt, before the 2p cut to national insurance and the various other tax changes that he made, he actually had about £12 billion to spend. Now, that is a little bit lower than what he was left over with in November. At that point, he had about £13 billion. Then before that autumn statement, he had somewhere around about £30 billion aside. Now, he chose to obviously spend about £10 billion that on the additional national insurance cut. Also chose to use some of that money elsewhere on some of the NHS productivity stuff as well. So I think that there will be money there when Labour, if they do win election and come in, and it will just entirely depend on how they want to choose to spend out. Now, obviously, they can keep with the Tories' plan at the moment. They can maintain the national insurance cuts if they want to. That will mean that they'll be spending money on tax cuts. Or they can decide to increase spending. They can obviously put money into the NHS, they can put money into the legal system. I mean, the OBR yesterday was saying, if you look at the spending plans when they were set out in October 2021, bear in mind it's the last time we had a spending review, so it's nearly 3 years ago now, so yeah. Some time. The OBR is saying if you look at the real terms trajectory of where that is going, it's going to be 8% lower per person, which is a pretty punchy cut to public spending. So, again, it's like all these things. These are political choices. You can choose to spend the resources on tax cuts or public spending. I mean, obviously, Labour is more money to raise public spending than Conservatives, more money to use it for tax cuts. But there will be some money to use.
In terms of the forecast, and, you know, take forecasts with a pinch of salt because they're always wrong. Mm. But inflation coming down, but growth still pretty terrible. You know, in the long term, over the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, this is the big story of the economy, right, since 2008. You know, we've had this very, very sharp slowdown in GDP growth compared to the decade running up to the financial crisis in 2008. You know, Britain was pretty well placed in terms of the G7, in terms of our growth figures running up to that. We looked pretty good. That sort of endowed the previous Labour government with Blair and Brown some resources to tweak the tax system a bit more, gave them a bit more room to actually do things which can change people's living standards. Since 2008, successive governments have been facing this very, very tough growth slowdown, which has been driven by various things, one of which has been slower productivity. That's reduced tax revenues. It's then forced the government into making more tougher decisions. So the trade-offs in that situation become a lot more sharper. And if you look at and obviously you mentioned, you know, the headroom, which was left over after all the tax measures yesterday, the headroom is only £8.9 billion, which is the second lowest on record since the OBR was created in 2010. And again, it all comes down to the fact that we have feeble growth in the economy, and that makes
these... And that $8 billion disappears like that.
As soon as there's any sort of change in interest rate, I mean, it's all wiped out.
Just zooming out a little bit, is there any prospect, given all of the instability we've had, you know, politically over the last 3 or 4 years, you know, actually you could probably date a lot of it, right, even to Brexit, you know, what's going to happen, people putting off decisions. If a new government came in with a decent majority and it looked like they were going to be there for a while, would that release any pent-up investment? The businesses just say, oh, okay, fine, we at least know what we're dealing with in the next 5 years. Could just the very act of a change of government have an impact on the state of the economy?
Yeah, I think we're kind of, it sort of speaks to the economics and almost the politics of this point, is that the country kind of feels as if it's in this sort of state of suspension at the moment. Everyone's kind of waiting for the election to happen. Everyone wants to know when it's going to happen. And then once it does, we're going to get certainty in terms of what is the political outlook going to be. Obviously, you know, if the polls are correct, Labour is going to get a fairly chunky majority. I think that will probably be good for the city, because they'll know full well that when Labour does put forward their fiscal plans, when they do come, when the first budget does come, and, you know, Rachel Reeves delivers that first budget in the chambers. And then I think for the city, they just want to know that the policy outlook is going to be stable. And I think if you look at the track record of the current government over the last 2 years, and what a lot of business leaders say is the one deterrent to business investment has been the enormous change in fiscal policy that we've been getting a lot over the last couple of years.
Jack, that's really useful. Thank you for that. Jack Barnett there, the economics correspondent for The Times, giving us a picture of what might be waiting for Rachel Reeves in the Treasury. So we know that if Labour wins, money will be tight. So how will they pay for the things that they want to do? Rachel Reeves has always insisted that she won't reach for borrowing. Here she is making that point on Times Radio Today.
If you know one thing about me, is that I'm absolutely committed to fiscal responsibility. Everything I do will always be fully costed.
But she also doesn't want to increase taxes.
We've always been clear. We want taxes on working people to be lower. And we welcome the cuts in national insurance, but it has to be seen in the context of a tax-raising parliament.
So, no big borrowing spree, no tax rises either. Patrick McGuire, Times Radio Senior Political Correspondent here. How do you make that work? There's no easy options, are there?
Well, the question you have to ask is this pre-election positioning, or is it sincerely believed? And the interesting thing about the shadow cabinet Keir Starmer has amassed and the team he's amassed is there is a mixture of both. Keir Starmer's not an economist. He didn't come to politics with a fully formed theory of how the economy works. Rachel Reeves is an economist, and I think she's a more complex and original thinker than someone who simply thinks you should approach the public finances like an accountant. But it's certainly true to say, as we'll hear from Rachel Reeves again and again and again over the coming year, that the Tories are pursuing a scorched earth strategy, that the spending plans Labour will inherit are essentially fictional. And if you don't want to make the mistakes that lots of Labour people diagnose retrospectively as Labour governments and oppositions having made about the economy, then what you can say is limited, and what you can do is also limited by the public finances if you want to keep your word. And I think this Labour Party will want to keep its word, whether it's just rhetorical or sincerely meant as a theory of how the economy should work.
Let's bring in Chris Ward, former Deputy Chief of Staff in Keir Starmer's team. We've got Cathy McLeod, who was an advisor to Labour's last Chancellor, Alistair Darling. Catherine, you were there when a Chancellor heading into an election, he thought he was going to lose. And are your decisions that you're making ones that are political rather than economic? What did you make of what Jeremy Hunt was doing yesterday, shooting several Labour foxes, taking the policy of abolishing non-dom status? That money was going to go on reducing NHS waiting lists, home insulation schemes, extending the windfall tax on oil and gas profits for another year. Labour wants to extend that and use the money elsewhere. What did you make of it? Was this a budget which was more about tying the hands of Labour, Catherine?
I thought so. I thought it was very much pandering to the Conservative Party as much as the country, and making life very difficult for a Labour government, or if there is going to be one, or even for himself if the Tories are going to win. I think one of the things, the consequences of yesterday, is that Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer have been very loath to tell us what their plans are. I think they will be even more loath now, because up until yesterday, or until they started briefing in the press last weekend, the Tories have been completely opposed to non-doms and made very good arguments about why we shouldn't get rid of the non-dom status. So I think that Labour will be sitting there thinking, well, we're not going to give them any more of that ideas, because they will just lift them, because he still has room for another fiscal event. But at the time when I was in the Treasury, coming out of the Treasury, there was a genuine debate between number 11 and number 10 about whether or not we went into the election and had a budget that was popular or perhaps more realistic. And that was because of the tension between Alistair and Gordon at the time.
Because Alistair wanted a sort of a realistic budget which took into account the state of the nation's finances and the fact that there were going to have to be spending cuts. And Gordon Brown just never... Well, it was a huge deal. The biggest story in politics for weeks was that Gordon Brown had even used the word cuts. And that's the tension you get between a prime minister who wants to be re-elected and a chancellor essentially trying to, quote, do the right thing.
That's right. And I think, I mean, in the past, chancellors have done the right thing. I think Roy Jenkins, I think it was at Newer Times podcast and the Peter Mandelson podcast, they were talking about... I think Roy Jenkins in the 70s, who was more interested in providing a narrative for the country rather than the Labour Party. Perhaps it cost the Labour Party the election. I mean, both Mandelson and Danny Finkelstein thought not. But yesterday, there was no narrative about what the and it was very disappointing, about what kind of country Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak we heard a lot about tax. We didn't hear anything about public services. If he's going to protect the National Health Service and child benefit and do some of the good things he wants to talk about, consequences for the other departments seem to be awful. And I think politicians have got to start treating us all as if we're stupid, because we know that if money is going to A, it means it's coming away from B. So I think we've got to start trying to have a more honest debate. Mm-hmm. And I think the way he played politics yesterday with I don't blame him, but the way he played politics yesterday with the non-doms and windfall tax is going to make that debate less likely than more likely.
Chris, what Jeremy Hunt has done is sort of create two problems for Rachel Reeves. She's now got to find ways to pay for the things he wanted to do, the NHS and breakfast clubs and all that, because that money's gone because it's gone on with, you know, tax cuts, which he's done instead. But she's also got to find money for the things we don't yet know about.
Yep.
Presumably, there are some big ideas that would cost money, which were going to be the centrepiece of the Labour manifesto. And she needs to find a way to pay for them as well.
Yeah, I think this morning there's a little visual of Rachel and Keir trying to find some billions of pounds down the back of a sofa somewhere to fill that hole. But look, in terms of, you say problems created, I think Labour would take these problems really, in the big scheme, you know, coming into an election, if the biggest problem they've got is that the Conservatives have borrowed a policy that they've attacked for the last 2 years, and it's only 2 or 3 billion, which is obviously big in terms of spending, but in the big spectrum of what the government's going to spend, that isn't a big problem for Labour. And I think actually one way you can judge how effective a budget speech is how difficult it is for the Leader of the Opposition to respond to. And I used to do these with Keir, and I'd done it previously in another life with other people. And if you looked at Keir yesterday, I thought he looked very relaxed in his response. He wasn't editing stuff. He wasn't, having to come up with policy on the hoof. And I think that's because of two reasons. One, everything had been briefed in advance.
Yeah, that does so help.
It does
you
help.
You know everything is in it already.
It does. I remember being there for the year that Osborne announced a living wage in the final paragraph of his speech. And that you should have seen the chaos that caused with people responding to. But that's what you're taking on. There isn't really anything politically that difficult for Labour in this before the election, and that goes to your point. The political traps laid here are, can Labour find another way to replace the non-dom policy? I think that they can, and they will come back with that fully costed for the election. But the big question, as you say, is about what they do after the election, how they cover that. And I think what you saw from Labour yesterday was really a real focus. Their focus is very much on electoral strategy, not economic policy at the moment. And their default is lots of people don't believe that Labour will keep taxes low. And nobody doesn't believe that Labour will spend money on public services going forward. So their focus is on narrowing down the weakness on tax and not focusing so much on the other. And they will have to come to that after the election, I'm sure. But to be honest with you, I think if you'd have said to Starmer and Reeves a week ago that this is where they'd be landing off the budget, they'd be delighted.
I mean, the other thing that strikes me, Patrick, if you look at the sort of YouGov's polling, you know, the Labour Party 25, 26 points ahead in the headline voting intention. In the most recent one last month, they were 4 points ahead on the best party at handling the economy. The economy is still one of the areas where they are less strong. You know, they're on 26%, say the Trust Labour, 22% say the Conservatives. Other is, I think, or don't know, is sandwiched in between them. Other a bit lower. But it's not, they haven't sealed the deal on the economy. And everyone, you know, is the economy stupid? Now, in an election campaign where the Tories are hammering them on tax cuts, and they haven't been able to come up with lots of big whiz-bang retail policies because they can't raise the money for it, that could squeeze.
Well, yeah, and of course, no leader of the opposition has ever won an election being behind on either one of best prime minister and most trusted to run the economy. That was why Ed Miliband's poll leads in 2015 never really added up or smelt right, because on those two key indicators of public opinion, he was consistently behind. And I think this also explains, it's a sort of a chicken and egg situation. The reason Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves are being so undemonstrative and cagey about what their plans are, the substance of their plans, which, as has been reported before in the Times, will include a changing, or closing rather, of a load of tax loopholes to raise revenue. Rachel Reeves is still committed to hiking the rate of tax paid on private equity profits, for instance, despite a big business lobby against it. So there are plans there to raise revenue, but the Labour Party can't talk about it with their chests, as the kids would say, because that would invite the sort of concerted chorus of criticism from business that inevitably ends with lots of pages of newspapers devoted to business leaders saying we can't trust Labour in the economy, you know, less to the Telegraph signed by 100 business leaders. And someone close to Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves put it this way to me fairly recently. They said, look, everything we are doing, you've got to understand, we want the letter in the Financial Times, or indeed the Times, in the election campaign from 100 business leaders to be saying we endorse Labour's plans for the economy, or we think a Labour government is a good thing, not that famous letter in 2015 to the Daily Telegraph where you had 100 business leaders saying Labour would be a complete disaster, we're terrified of Ed Miliband.
Just to jump in and agree, if you were to say to Starmer and Reeves, what was the common denominator in Labour's last four election defeats? I mean, Labour's found lots of different ways to lose under lots of different leaders over lots of years, but they would say the common denominator is economic trust, and that too many voters thought Labour couldn't be trusted to not overspend. And that's why you played the clip earlier. Rachel will talk all the time about everything will be costed, fiscal rules, et cetera, and responsibility will come back, because that's how they think they win it. So when I said they will be less bothered by having to find a replacement for non-dom policy, the big thing is whether they are thought to be overspending going into election. And the other key reality is, look, you know, whatever Hunt says yesterday, you know, growth is flatlining, taxes are up, living standards are down, Labour's going to fight the election on that basis. And if they could promise not to, if they can get across clearly that they're not going to break fiscal rules and overspend, they think that's how they win the election.
I think just right. Yesterday, Hunt didn't talk about growth, about infrastructure, but there was nothing about planning. I think some people were expecting to sort of show some kind of route map. And I think Chris and Patrick are absolutely right, but I think Rachel is wanting to establish economic trust, make sure people are, that she's believable and credible, and that when she's speaking to the business in the city, she knows that she's going to not only need a letter to the Times from these guys, but she's going to need their money, because the level of public investment that's needed in this country cannot just come from the taxpayer. It's going to need these guys to and women to support it in trying to invest in the UK.
I mean, on a smaller scale, we had some figures in this morning from the Electoral Commission on donations to political parties. Conservative Party's got £9.8 million, the Labour Party £8.5 million. So they're doing all right, but, you know, there are still people who are putting money behind the Conservative Party, and that will align in part to because of their economic concerns. I want to talk about immigration, because the OBR says that net migration, which is the numbers entering the UK minus those who leave, so the net increase of the population caused by migration, will average 350,000 over the next 5 years, up from a prediction of only 290,000 a few months ago. And Rachel Reeves was asked about this specifically on Times Radio this morning.
Migration, of course, makes a positive contribution to our economy. And there are many people who work in my city of Leeds and around the country who make a positive contribution who have come from abroad. But we can't just rely on immigration to boost our GDP. We need to be skilling up people who are here. We need to be investing alongside businesses in the jobs and the industries of the future, because in the numbers yesterday, GDP per capita was revised down. And that's why the OBR confirmed yesterday this is the a first parliament on record where living standards will actually fall.
Now, Chris, I probably don't need to remind you about controls on immigration mugs, which played us a huge successful role in Ed Miliband's campaign in 2015. But Labour, this, you know, what immigration has been a problem for the Conservative Party. They've put it up in lights themselves. They've talked about small boats. They've talked about legal migration as well. But a Labour government whose growth is relying on enormous numbers of people coming here, they'll find that then becomes a... Because immigration is a massive public concern. And if you're the only way you can get any sort of growth is by letting loads of people in, that then becomes a Labour problem, not a Tory one.
Yeah, I mean, the first point is, you know, there is an irony that a post-Brexit Conservative government, now its only lever for economic growth is increased immigration. Yeah. But that is really the basis that allows Labour to talk about the issue, I think, a lot more. In 2015, the difference there was, I think, the Conservatives were much more trusted on immigration than they are now. The argument here will be, look, they've been running immigration at 600,000. Labour just has to put a plan in place that can bring it down in some fashion on that. But the other point is, Reeves will talk about it this morning, there'll be other mechanisms they want to pull, whether that's planning, whether that's skills, whether it's a Brexit deal to get closer to the EU to boost growth in some other fashion. They will want to argue there's more clubs in the bag that Labour has rather than Conservatives relying on immigration. But look, it's obviously a challenge for both parties, but the Conservatives' record on it now is so bad, I think it makes it much less dangerous territory for Labour to be fighting on.
Just finally then, looking ahead, if this does happen, and the polls suggest it will, Keir Starmer in number 10, Rachel Reeves in number 11, which Chancellor-Prime Minister relationship that we've seen before they most like? Is it Blair and Brown barely speaking to each other, not telling each other what's going on? Is it Osborne and Cameron apparently holding hands most of the time, apart from the thorny issue of the EU referendum? What do you think, Patrick?
Well, I want to propose a different vision of Blair and Brown, which is you had, and this is overly simplified, but you had Blair, who was pulling in one direction, i.e. away from the Labour tradition, or rather, you know, towards reassuring the electorate. Not to say Brown wasn't preoccupied with reassuring the electorate, he was. And then you had Brown, who was unquestionably to Blair's left, and was, you know, always very keen to ensure the government was redistributive and seen as redistributive. You do wonder whether Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves could be the same in reverse, i.e. Keir Starmer doesn't have a big theory of economics, as I said, but he has, you know, statist instincts, wants a big interventionist state, and will want to invest, if there is money to spend, on preventing social injustice. Now, it'd be really interesting to see if Rachel Reeves is the Chancellor, the sort of Chancellor she is, the Shadow Chancellor, which is all the, you know, I'm going to be a sort of the embodiment of Treasury orthodoxy, and whether Keir Starmer wants to pull in another direction, borrow to invest a little bit more, you know, that's, he said that's a fight he's absolutely prepared to have, and whether you have that same thing in reverse, where Keir Starmer is the person pulling the government in a more redistributive left-wing direction.
Interesting. What do you think, Chris?
Can I try sort of a third way between Osborne and Cameron? And, the big difference actually is that Osborne and Cameron and Brown and Blair had known each other for 10, 20 years before they got there. It was a shared project. Reeves and Starmer really weren't close before Keir becomes leader. It wasn't a shared project. They are now very, very close, and they do work closely. So they're friendly in that way. So it's more Cameron Osborne there. But yeah. The key bit, I think, is Starmer is to the left of Reeves on economic policy. And you saw that in the argument over 28 billion. You saw it over Borrow to Invest. Starmer does believe that. Reeves, though, I think, has the potential to be the most powerful Chancellor for quite a long time, in that economic policy is clearly being run from the Shadow Chancellor's office at the moment. And it isn't Starmer's big priority, as you say, Patrick. There are other areas that he's more focused on. So you might see it as more empowered Treasury under Reeves, I suspect.
Finally, Catherine, your advice, so it's not like Brown and Darling?
I don't think it should be like any of the people. I think they were pretty toxic relationships sometimes. I think David Cameron and George Osborne were too friendly. I think if they hadn't been so friendly, we might not have had the Brexit referendum. I think Gordon and Tony, I don't particularly agree with Patrick's analysis. I don't know who is to the right or to the left. But certainly with Alistair and Gordon, the big moments, Alistair and Gordon got on very well. It was things over a sort of, you know, just a problem about the cuts that was the issue at the end during the financial crisis had gone well. And as long as I think they've got respect for each other's positions, they'll be fine. But I don't think they should cozy up, and I don't think they should fall out.
Very good. Wise words there. Thank you very much. That's Cathy McLeod there, former advisor to Alistair Darling when he was Chancellor. Chris Wall, the former Deputy Chief of Staff to Keir Starmer, and Times Radio's senior political correspondent, Patrick McGuire. Thanks very much for taking us through
And you can read my column on this subject in the Times tomorrow.
Well, you know, I was about to say to you, that's a really good topic for you to cover in your column.
I'm very grateful to have a conversation with two esteemed colleagues. And
you don't make any phone calls.
No, exactly.
Yeah, you can read Patrick McGuire, of course, with your Times subscription. Plenty more analysis and reaction to the budget on thetimes.co.uk, which of course you can access with your subscription. Do get in touch. You can email me matt@times.radio or WhatsApp us 0333 003 2353. But for now, for me, Matt Cholley, it's goodbye.